You're listening to Woven, a podcast from Canaan. Woven stands for Women Who Venture and represents a platform, a community, and really a celebration of venturesome and adventurous women. I'm Laura Cho.
And I'm Nina Shelson.
We are investors at Canaan, an early stage venture capital firm that partners with founders to build the future of how we live, work, and thrive. Each episode, we share the journeys and wisdom of remarkable women working in life science, technology, and business. Welcome to Woven.
I'm Nina Shelson, and today I'm talking to Megan Jones-Bell. She is Chief Strategy and Scientific Officer at Headspace, overseeing medical and clinical affairs, behavioral science and clinical research, design research, and the company's digital health subsidiary, Headspace Health. Megan's career started in the world of academia at Stanford University, but as she grew more aware of the need for new technology-centered healthcare, she also realized the importance of having someone with her training and experience leading that effort. She made a leap and founded Lantern, an evidence-based digital mental health company that pushed employers to acknowledge the importance of mental health. In 2017, Headspace recruited Megan, uprooting her life in Austria and reshaping the business from a consumer-level daily meditation app to the enterprise-level, multidimensional mental health provider that it is today. It's clear through talking with Megan that she truly lives their mission by prioritizing her own mental health, valuing and investing in her family time, creating an environment where people can learn and flourish, and working in alignment with her values. We explore how the company reacted with agility and speed to adjust its offerings at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, listening to and acting on feedback from within its workforce and its members. From free access for healthcare workers and the unemployed to reshaping the working week, we discuss how to put the mental health and needs of ourselves and our employees first. A quick content warning. In this episode, we discuss disordered eating and we touch on suicide. Megan Jones-Bell, welcome to Woven. We're so thrilled to have you here today, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time. I'd like to start by helping the audience get to know you. So why don't we begin at the beginning? Where did you grow up and how did that place and those people shape you?
Well, first, thank you so much, Nina, for having me on. I actually grew up in Palo Alto. And so growing up in the heart of Silicon Valley, going to school with many of the daughters of kind of the tech world elite really made me take for granted that kind of expansive thinking that is so classic of, you know, the Bay Area and Silicon Valley in particular. And so I think for me, it just encoded in my DNA this belief that just because it doesn't exist now doesn't mean it's not possible.
You're born into the valley of the only limitation is the human imagination and grit and will. But you went in Silicon Valley, so you talked about the daughters of all these tech giants. You mentioned daughters because you went to an all-girls school for your primary education. I'm curious if you'd share a little bit about what that was like and the pros and cons in your mind of an all-girls education.
Well, I think it really depends on the kid. I was, I think, in third grade when my dad took me to the visit for what would be kind of starting in sixth grade for me. And I just remember this panel of superstar girls who I thought, you know, I could never be like them, but they were so inspiring to me as like an 8-year-old, determined one to get away from the annoying boys in my elementary school, and just so inspired by these girls who were doing things that felt out of reach or intimidating to me. And so I really was excited to go to this particular school. And it was a great fit for me. I was an incredibly shy kid. I was really book smart, but socially, you know, just more cautious, shall we say. So me going into a large environment really wouldn't have helped me reach my potential. And I got to be that girl on the panel as the yearbook editor and on the cross country team. And so it was just an incredible experience. It was really one of the most powerful chapters of my very long education. And, you know, the friends have stayed with me to this day.
The sisterhood is alive and well. Did you reflect then on different ways that girls versus boys learn or develop or the shaping of the adolescent mind in any ways that made you think that you'd grow up to study psychology?
Did you have a fixed idea of what you wanted to be?
I've always had a fixed idea of what I wanted to be. It just changed dramatically over time. But you know, that the research on girls learning in the classroom relative to boys was actually a big part of my decision to go there. It was something that my dad helped me understand. We talked a lot about that research. You know, this is to a fifth grader. And so that was part of what made, you know, the case for one, why he was willing as a doctor to take on, you know, a second job so that we could afford to send me there. But it really was, I think, part of that rationale. So it's always been in my mind, but to me, it's really, you see that with girls, but I think so much of it also has to do with your temperament and personality. So it's really, how do you get each kid in a perfect world into the right environment for them to learn and flourish?
So you made your first data-driven well-being decision back in fifth grade, but we'll get to that. So you spent most of your early career in academia at Stanford, which is interesting, but academia can sometimes feel like a pressure cooker, a push to conduct research. And curious if you share a little bit about what drew you to wanting to study there and what the environment was like for your interest and your somewhat shyer, more cautious personality type.
Well, you know, my dad thought I was going completely nuts by when I applied there for graduate school, because my graduate program was, you know, I was going into one of the very first classes of this program. It was not yet APA accredited because it hadn't actually matriculated a class yet. And so, whereas I could have gone to graduate school that someone else would have paid for research, I was going on, you know, taking on enormous debt, going, you know, to something that was completely new. But I was absolutely determined to work with a particular professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford. His name is Seabart Taylor, and it's still a dear friend to this day. But he was really one of the early pioneers of digital health research, particularly in mental health. I had read his research when I was in college because I had developed a school-based mental health prevention program and was really struggling to scale that because it was volunteer-based and in person. And he had, you know, already demonstrated that he could accomplish the same thing, reducing risk factors for mental health conditions through what was an online program. He even had a CD-ROM version of it before that. And so it was really the only way I could figure out how I could work with him, because I really went into graduate school with the purpose of, I wanted to learn evidence-based treatments and I wanted to develop and evaluate digital health interventions, because my main, you know, driver and motivation has always been an interest in scaling access to preventative interventions and closing this gap in access that we have around for treatment.
Instead of one-to-one, one to very many.
Right.
Were there particular mental health challenges that drew you first into psychology, or that you were working on, for example, in the peer health stuff in college? I know you worked some on self-image and eating disorders, but I'm curious sort of what your on-ramp was into the various areas that you are working in now.
Well, it's a very personal on-ramp. I have a mom who has, you know, very serious and chronic mental health issues. I had a number of, you know, kind of explosive things happen in my family growing up that ultimately caught up with me. And so I developed an eating disorder and, you know, struggled with anorexia nervosa for about 6 years. I hit my rock bottom when I was a freshman in college and had to take a medical leave to get treatment. So once I was in treatment for my eating disorder, I was responding really quickly because once I finally kind of that switch flipped, and I one got access to great care, but I also decided I don't want to let this control me. I want to get, you know, overcome this. I put all of that drive and perfectionism that had fueled my eating disorder into my recovery. And so I recovered really quickly, but that left me with this goal of, I don't want anyone else to experience what I did. This could have been prevented, or my risk could have been mitigated had I been able to talk about my emotions, had I, you know, learned how to do that, had I not internalized stigma around mental health such that I was, you know, unwilling to let anyone know that I was struggling. And when the many different, you know, parents of of dear friends tried to get me to talk about what was going on. I just would never, you know, I was never willing to share how much I was struggling. I think in part because, you know, when my mom was hospitalized during my adolescence, we said she had pneumonia, not that she, you know, had made a suicide attempt. And so that, you know, was really a powerful learning that I decided, you know, I want to turn something that is extremely negative into something that's actually a source of strength for me and a source of positive impact for other people. And so that was really a natural first place for me to kind of focus my clinical work, my research, because eating disorders are so stigmatized even within psychology. You know, there are healthcare professionals who don't understand them. They don't want to work with eating disorder patients. They blame them for their illnesses. And so the empathy that I could bring as someone with lived experience, I felt would be a really positive addition to that, you know, academic and clinical community.
Well, first, thank you so much for sharing so openly. I think it means a lot. It does to me, but I'm sure it will mean a lot to those who listen, because I think it is such a pervasive and underdiagnosed condition. And I think we're facing just increased pressure for girls to achieve and to be perfect, and social media amplification of the ideal, that it's something that continues to need a tremendous amount of conversation and address. And like you say, destigmatization, because it's so, so common. So I want to thank you for sharing and for leaning in to do that work. You brought that foundation of building digital curricula to be more accessible for eating disorders and body image, self-esteem, and anxiety to a whole new level when you moved into the non-academic, but to the industry side of that. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that transition and what feels different in business versus academia at first blush.
You know, I was a very reluctant entrepreneur, but I think, you know, after being indoctrinated into the academy, you know, being, you know, finally kind of climbing my way up the ladder at Stanford, I really was reluctant to let go of my academic career. And I really intended to stay in academia forever.
Sure, especially given the incredible climb that it is.
Exactly. I also at the time felt like there would be some kind of contamination or corruption of me and my intentions if I moved into the for-profit world. I think sometimes in science you have this idea of industry as, you know, being only motivated for profit, and I really wanted nothing to do with that. I have and still continue to have a social impact goal for my career, and of, you know, I'm motivated by the impact I want to make on society. How that, you know, benefits me financially, I is really an afterthought. And so I approached this leap into industry quite reluctantly. And so we started Lantern. I reluctantly took a leave of absence that ended up being 3 years long and then permanent from Stanford. It was a slow transition. They were very, you know, supportive during that transition. But, you know, we went around trying to fundraise for Lantern seed round and then Series A. And I think most of the investors with whom we spoke thought we were totally crazy to talk to them about mental health at that point.
Absolutely. Yeah, you were really a pioneer into what's now a significant slice of the digital health and tech-enabled services healthcare segment. But as an entrepreneurial venture 10, 12 years ago, it was groundbreaking.
But it was a really empowering leap for me to make what was, you know, being able to work with best-in-class engineers and, you know, designers to actually build something that people would want to use. I have built many things that were clinically effective in academia, but as you well know, the engagement and usage and the desirability for that is the other half of the equation. And so been able to continue to work with just incredible, you know, design researchers and developers to build products that actually, you know, are used by people, which then means, you know, my contribution to it, you know, means that evidence-based interventions will actually reach people.
So during that transition from Stanford into Lantern, what was the biggest naysayer voice And what was the biggest cheerleader voice in your life at that time? And perhaps they were both inside your head.
Well, they were definitely in my head. I mean, certainly my, academic mentors at Stanford wanted me to stay there because the feedback I got from them is, you're a high potential researcher. You could actually have an academic career, and to give that up and walk away from it is, a huge loss. I also had this guilt. I had trained in these therapies that very few people know how to do worldwide. And so I also thought about my decision is I'm taking a resource off the market if I am not able to treat your child's mental health disorder. So there was some hesitation and some fear, because at that point, if Lantern didn't work out and I couldn't go back to Stanford, this was after I really resigned, there was no other job for me that existed, because it's not like there were a dozen digital behavioral health companies out there that would want, someone like me to join. Mm-hmm. So it was probably, the biggest leap forward I've made in recovering from perfectionism, but it was also a little terrifying at the same time.
I bet it was an interesting tension too, leaving tenure professor, female technical field in an Ivy, highest sort of attained status as a woman at a time where that's rare. Jumping to be a female first founder in a tech-enabled healthcare company is also, a rarity. So you're sort of darned if you do, darned if you don't, because as you lead in one, you're taking a leadership icon away from the other.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that was really clear to me, though, was if we are actually going to build this, digital behavioral health company, someone like me needs to have a seat at the table where decisions are made. And so that was really what compelled me to make that change, because I just firmly believed that, I understand the person for whom we're designing this. I understand the clinical aspects. I'm beholden to a code of ethics around the practice of psychology and the laws around the practice of psychology, which are designed to protect the safety of patients. And so I just really worried that as innovation, moved into this space, that companies without that clinical leadership would inadvertently do harm. And so I was really there for quality control at the beginning.
Absolutely. I mean, that evidence first, science first instinct that you had back at fifth grade going to Castalea obviously carried all the way through. And I think you're absolutely so right. Not just for patients' benefit on the individual basis, but also as a system, we deserve to have evidence-based solutions out there creating value, and not to have a lot of energy and expense spent on things that don't have the evidence base and aren't rooted in clinical science. So that brings us a bit to Headspace, which is, certainly not today, the baby startup that you founded at Lantern. Today, it's what touches some 60 plus million people with the meditation apps, bringing meditation and mindfulness to the world. Tons of employer-sponsored subscriptions as well, so bringing it into networks for employees for mindfulness and well-being. And then recently launched a health division too. So the company has really been on quite a tear. What was it like when you joined?
It was probably the least opportune time for me to change jobs, because I was 6 months pregnant and living in Vienna, Austria at the time. And, I had gone back and forth to San Francisco, where my startup was based, the whole time. But I was determined that once I had this child, that my husband and I would actually be in the same city. But nonetheless, Headspace hired me and let me live abroad for the first year until my husband could find an academic job in LA, which felt like an insurmountable challenge in and of itself. But I think we had 12 million members and downloads at that time, and had no, enterprise business. Shortly after I arrived, we launched the Headspace for Work offering, which is our employer offering. As you mentioned, that's now grown to 1,100 enterprise customers, making Headspace available to their employees and dependents in some cases. And for healthcare, you know, this is obviously very connected to our employer offering, you know, where we really position the Headspace for Work program as a mental health benefit, albeit on the mental well-being side of that spectrum. But we've also been working on integrating Headspace into care. So we work with a number of IDNs and health systems to enable, you know, primary care physicians or behavioral health professionals to recommend Headspace to their patients and actually prescribe it in some cases, you know, through, you know, digital formularies or kind of app registries that these health systems maintain. We've also been working with health plans, but an important step that we decided to take a year and a half ago was to invest in Headspace Health, which is a subsidiary that's actually building a completely new intervention for management of chronic conditions. And so that was started as a leadership venture for me for the Aspen Health Innovators Fellowship. Headspace was extremely supportive of it, and I've made, you know, incredible progress. I really love what the team has built. So we have always had international members, but we were only in English when I joined. We're now in 5 languages. The majority of our members are actually outside of the United States. And so we were also only audio guided meditation, and now have, you know, mindful movement, workouts, runs, a whole sleep offering. We've launched focus mode. And so continue to add, you know, new experiences to make the app more of a holistic mindfulness offering.
I have so many questions about your journey there, but I'm curious, what made you want to join Headspace? What spoke to you to say that the team, the founders, the business was the place that you were going to plant your roots?
I had actually been a Headspace user since their very first version of the app. I used my kind of discretionary wellness budget from my own company to pay for my Headspace subscription, which was really how Headspace's employer business started, with employees doing that and then asking their employers to pick up the tab. I also had been a longtime meditator. I was extremely, as a, you know, someone who's very driven and, you know, has some perfectionistic tendencies, shall we say, graduate school.
Unlike any other woman that I know.
So graduate school was just like the perfect environment for my stress to get completely out of control. And because, you know, in my program, I was doing research like a PhD, but I also had a full course load on top of that and like 20 hours of clinical practice. And I had some leadership responsibilities for our graduate program. So it was a time when I really needed to learn how to manage stress. I ended up developing migraines and having like different, you know, undiagnosable stomach pain. And so my doctor, a neurologist, told me, you know, I don't usually have to recommend this to people like you, but you know, maybe you should try to manage your stress. And so I took the mindfulness-based stress reduction course, both at Stanford and at Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And that really kickstarted my mindfulness practice.
Amazing. So you were sort of a customer and believer before you became a strategist.
Yeah. And, you know, Andy Puddicombe is our co-founder. He's also been our in-house former monk and mindfulness expert really since the beginning. He met Rich Pearson, who's the other co-founder of Headspace and CEO, when Rich had been a successful ad exec, dropped out of that, was training to be an acupuncturist. He met Andy at this integrative medicine clinic where Andy was working in London, and they decided to skill swap. And then eventually, you know, Andy listened and Rich, you know, finally convinced him to start an app. So, but they are, you know, two of the most values-driven people, just unbelievably humble and authentic. And so as a woman, you can really understand where you choose to plant yourself matters. And I could just tell really out of the gate that these would be two people who lifted me up, made space for me. And, you know, it's just been so true. I think I've been pushed by Rich out of my comfort zone and told numerous times by him, like, I believe you can do this. I know you can. And I'm saying, like, no, I don't think I can. I've never done that before. Why do you want me to take that over? Because I can be completely honest and authentic with him. And so, you know, one, they're people I trust. I believe in. They have incredible values, but they are also, you know, so happy to celebrate other people's successes. And so I just felt like, you know, this would be an environment in which I have the space to learn. I have the encouragement to learn and, you know, be honest about the challenges inherent in, you know, moving out of your comfort zone, really learn how to be an operator as well as provide kind of science and clinical leadership.
Yeah, it sounds like very conscious leaders that are really true to their word and true to their vision. It also is a really interesting segue, I think, to one of the other things we really wanted to talk about today, which is authenticity and being real. The world got really, really real with the pandemic and everyone, you know, sheltering at home and re-engineering their lives to accommodate a totally different way of living, separated from loved ones and family, many experiencing loss or severe hardship as a consequence. And then that was quickly followed in late spring, early summer with probably the most intense racial and social justice confrontation this country has had in our generation with the murder of George Floyd. And you are not only steering strategy and envisioning product for Headspace, where you have millions of people looking to the app to provide perhaps some peace and respite and thinking about programming that might help in this new world that we're living in. But you also have a large organization of employees at Headspace, where you represent someone too, as a working mom with a young one at home, trying to juggle this in new circumstances. And so I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how you as a leader and the company, as a leading company, responded and continue to respond to create the culture that you and your founders dream of and that you wish for the world to have.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for us in March, we had this dual mission of how do we set this team up for success and help the Headspace family transition to this new reality, make sure that they're set up at home in a way that is comfortable for them, give them the flexibility that they need to adjust as a family. Meanwhile, we need to think as hard as we can about what role we have to play in helping, you know, the broader community. I think every decision we've made has been through this this two-sided lens of what are we doing for our team and what are we doing, you know, for the rest of the world. And we've been able to learn both ways. And so some of our recommendations for the companies with whom we work through Headspace for Work have actually been based on things that we've tried and experimented with internally. We held immediately a number of listening sessions. It's kind of standard to our way of designing our product is we go into research, we talk to our members, we talk to potential members, we understand their needs, we don't just assume. And we did the same thing with our employees. We launched first this free selection of content called Weathering the Storm that was in the app, ungated from our paywall, and also kind of on the web, freely available. That was selection of content that we thought was most relevant to what people were likely going through. And we followed that up with a free offering for all healthcare professionals in the United States. We then expanded that to free for all NHS employees and then free to all French physicians. That was more a result of who we could partner with and access kind of eligibility file information, meaning like we would need to verify that someone was a practicing physician in France, for example. And we've also partnered with Governor Cuomo in New York, Governor Whitmer in Michigan to provide free access to Headspace for residents of those states while they were going through surges. We've also partnered with LA County here to provide free access to the app for all residents of LA County. And then we follow that all up with free for unemployed in the US and UK. And so for a period of time, made the app available to anyone who was unemployed. And so we really built this into what we call the Headspace promise, which is a promise that when there is enormous need, we will show up and find a way of, you know, supporting the community in the way that we can. And so in the context of Black Lives Matter, we also made a number of changes. We engaged a creative diversity director and a number of other experts to guide our content development and production efforts to ensure that we have content in the app that is, you know, designed by, featuring, and for communities of color, and really accelerate our move away from having only, you know, a white male voice or white female voice in the app. And so this was something that we had intended to do already. We were moving in that direction, but really quickly accelerated because we realized this is something that we should have done already. And we want to make sure that we have that representation at all points in our process, and that we really have the intention of being an app that's relevant for all communities. And so that did require a change in how we do things.
Absolutely. You dug in so consciously and with such purpose in both directions. I'm curious how you're thinking as a parent about your son growing up in this changing world and changing conversation, and what you wish for him, and how, if at all, you've talked to him about any of the protests or the discourse that he might be picking up.
Yeah, well, I think about it a lot. I mean, we have, I think through a variety of different ways, I'm trying to educate him about, you know, what racism is, about what our family believes our role is. So to really teach him, you know, values and expectations. But I also believe I need to model that for him. So I went to the protests when they were here in LA. I went to go clean up the city of Santa Monica, actually, with a number of people on my team at Headspace after, you know, there was a lot of looting and damage to small businesses in our own community, and explained to him why I was going and what I was there to do, and in a developmentally appropriate way. But it was really important to me to have him see that mom hasn't left our neighborhood in, you know, months, and now she's, you know, she's going somewhere. This must be significant. And it was. Yeah. And so we read books and talk about it. We watch shows together and, you know, pause. I ask him questions. You know, I find that when we're on walks or around bedtime, it's a great opportunity to ask him questions and kind of have him explore his thinking to find out how he thinks, you know, a character feels about something in a book, and ask him questions that, you know, elicit empathy, elicit awareness, but also, you know, it's really important to me that he knows what racism is, that it is real, that it's happening to people around him, that it happens to people he knows, and that he has a, you know, obligation to take action. I've done a lot of work around bystander training. And so, you know, in a three-year-old appropriate way already, you know, when we were able to be on playgrounds, talk to him about, you know, I just saw that kid do that, you know, mean thing to another kid. Did you see that too? What are you going to do about it? And actually have a conversation with him about, you know, when something happens to someone else that you don't think is okay, you know, you go over and check on them and ask if they're okay. You go get a grown-up. And so, you know, what does a three-year-old do when they see a bully? He should know that. I want him to feel accountable for the way that other people are treated around us. We had a car nearby picking up a spouse who's a caregiver in our neighborhood, and the police were there checking on him. It was a very, you know, broken down car, and so I took my son and we walked over and we asked him, you know, if everything was all right and if he needed anything to just come over to our house. But it was important that I took him there, that we wave, we ask the guy what his name is, we say our names, we build, you know, a relationship. He's in our neighborhood, and it, you know, explain to him why it wasn't okay that the police went to his car and not any others. To me, it's, I need to involve him in a, you know, developmentally appropriate way, but he needs to see me do it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And again, it harnesses that presence that you're cultivating not only for yourself, but that you're really building as a business at Headspace, that mindfulness and conscious living. That's how we grow values. I love it. How do you think the culture is these days at Headspace? And what are some tips for keeping sort of culture engaged and supported, and also feeling a sense of fun and family at work, even when folks are working remotely. Any tips for leaders or managers out there trying to keep their teams energized and connected?
Well, I think we're all probably a little tired of the Zoom happy hours at this point, but we have really tried to create more flexibility for our team. So we moved to essentially a 4-day work week. One, Fridays alternate between no meeting days and what we call mind days, which are just days off. And this was a direct request from our team saying they just needed more time to manage, you know, the kind of personal life than they did before. We also have had our program management organization look at all of the recurring meetings, because, you know, we always try to maintain good meeting hygiene. But in the shift to Zoom, I think we really filled in everyone's calendars. And so editing that back has been important. And that's, you know, never done. That's a kind of on repeat forever, likely. But we've also been, you know, trying to create ways of using our own product together. And so whether that is doing kind of one of our Move workout videos together, we've always had all company meditations at 10:05 every morning. And we've always had a 30-minute calendar block at 3:00 where we have different suggestions for how to take a mindful break. We're encouraging people to turn off their video and go for a walk if it's a call that they can take without needing to see a screen. And so I think it's really, to me, been about empowering people to do what they already know they need to do to manage, you know, the different poles that they have in their life.
And modeling that as leaders. I think so much of culture is modeled from setting those meetings or setting those agendas. I think that's great. So what are you doing for yourself to celebrate wins during this time, and to find a little bit of levity in what's clearly a big juggle?
Well, I have a 3-year-old, and so
your joy is sleeping when you can.
Oh, that is just unspeakable joy. When I practice what I preach and I am present with him, that is just like, it's the biggest reset button that I have. If I can really tune in and, you know, put my phone away, we've just developed family rituals, which I think are so important for children developmentally. They're so important for all of us as we have, you know, this rising uncertainty in the world. And so every day at 5:30, usually my whole family, we all go out on a walk around our entire neighborhood. We now know dozens and dozens of neighbors that we never spoke to before. And so we just got this incredible community that was always right here, but we never had time to really fully appreciate before. And so we're lucky to live in a place where it's safe to walk around outside and it's beautiful. And so it's things like that that really bring lightness to my days. And I think that's what's important, is that those routines and rituals that you build are daily routines. Yeah. Because we, you know, it is this ultimate transition from work life to home life to just get out and play.
Absolutely. And it's silver linings that I think we should strive to keep, even as we may go back to working more like we did before all of this.
Yeah.
Anything that you want to share that fuels you, or what you'd like to advise to other women? Anything that's been great advice that you've received that you'd like to pass on?
Yeah, Ann Devereaux Mills, who really helped start Lantern. She was advising me in my lab about, you know, how I could translate this research into a commercial venture. She really was the instrumental person. She was the first investor, et cetera. She joined the board. But she told me, she's a, you know, multi-time female CEO, that there would be chapters in my life where I was, you know, on the accelerator moving up, and then there'd be chapters where I was maintaining, and that I needed to not expect my life and career to just be a straight line up into the right, that I would need to embrace periods of, you know, being okay feeling like I'm not making progress professionally, but because there were demands on me from another part of my life. And that hasn't happened to me yet. I've been lucky to be able to you know, feel like I'm, you know, making professional gains, but it gave me permission to decide, you know, is this a good time for me and my family to take on this additional challenge? And so, you know, this really came to a head for me about one, it was a huge factor in how I was considering taking this job at Headspace while I was about to have a baby living in another country. Mm-hmm. But the way that that advice shaped the conversation I had with my husband, you know, really helped me see that he was willing to put my career first. What it really led to is me asking, are you willing to do this? I'm okay to find something else and, you know, stay flat because we have a baby, but this is an opportunity to really grow for me. And he said, you know, no, you just put my career first by flying back and forth across the world for 5 years so that I could take this job in Austria while you had a company in San Francisco. The next 5 years are yours. And so let's, you know, you make the decision. I'll figure it out like you did. I think as ambitious, driven women, we often have a hard time giving that permission to ourselves.
And it is something I think that those of us who've been lucky enough to achieve and to be equal or better earners in our partnered relationships can't take for granted. So in a two-income household, if something's got to give because of a greater caregiving burden, whether it's kids learning or otherwise, it tends to be the lower income female who steps out of the workplace. And so it's definitely a mantle that we need to keep championing for equality of opportunity and pay. So those decisions can be for most people as well, partnered and balanced and nurturing as yours has been with your husband. And it sounds like that's almost one, appreciate that you may have fits and starts in a increasingly long careers because we're living well and with meditation, we're living with well-being, but we're living long and working long. And so there may be fits and starts when you make room for other things. But the other piece of advice perhaps is if you're lucky enough to partner well with someone who's in that conversation with you about how to make it work for the whole family unit.
Yeah.
So you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Sure.
Do you have an exercise routine?
I used to have a, you know, much more intensive one before COVID and a three-year-old, but it's our walk. I mean, we basically do a hour-long walk at a three-year-old's scootering pace, which means I'm intermittently sprinting along around our neighborhood every day. And then my husband and I do, well, we sometimes have the three-year-old join, which is a little hard at times, but it's quite funny to watch him try to do Pilates. But we try to do Pilates really just so our backs don't ache trying to keep up with the three-year-old.
What would you say is your superpower?
I would say empathy. I over-index, probably why I was a psychologist.
And if you could have a new superpower, an additional one, if you could just blink and have it, what would you want?
I would want to make other people be nicer to each other.
And have you made a purchase that you're especially excited about during COVID?
A basketball hoop. It was, I think, the first week of Safer at Home. I thought of how am I possibly going to get all of the energy out of this three-year-old? But it's been a really fun new activity for all of us. So it's a very short hoop, but we all play together.
That's great. Well, I'd ask you what mobile app you use the most, but I'm hopeful that it's Headspace.
Headspace or the New York Times. I need one to cope with the other. Guess which one it is. Yeah.
This was wonderful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
In a time when many of us are turning to meditation and mindfulness for the first time, or increasing our practice to mirror the rise in stress and anxiety, it's comforting, even inspiring, to see that the people providing our resources not only understand our needs, but are reacting and reshaping their services as our situations change. Megan's core people-first approach continues to leave its mark. Thank you, Megan Jones-Bell, for taking the time to speak to us. And thank you for listening. This episode was produced by Steph Colburn and Maria Passingham at Edit Audio. For more information on our conversations and to become part of the Woven community, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and head to kanan.com/woven.